Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to episode 231 of Five and Dive. It is Tuesday, August 2nd. It is the trade deadline special episode of Five and Dive. I am your host, Craig Goldstein, editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus. Join me as my co-hosts today, just as they did last trade deadline, CBS staff writer RJ Anderson and Yahoo staff writer Zach Kreiser. RJ, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, but I believe Kreiser has a fancier title than that these days.
No, I talked to Zach. Listeners will know that, but I believe I asked Zach what it was, and he just said, I don't know, go with writer.
Yeah, I'm a writer.
We had the same conversation last week, me and Craig, so that makes me feel better. Also makes me feel worse, because I really, in my head, had you placed on a pedestal, so that's a bummer.
Well, I think we're all happy with it. I think, I guess my first question to you guys, really, aside, well, I said, RJ, how are you doing? Zach, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I survived the Soto apocalypse.
Yeah, I was going to say, how was this? I feel like this was not as bad as last year's in terms of overall volume. I have not seen people count up the deals and the number of players moved, but last year felt much worse to me, I guess.
I think last year was worse because I had to write two Max Scherzer trade stories because the Padres traded for him and then the Dodgers traded for him. So really, yeah, this year was better because no one swooped in and stole the Padres trade after.
Eric Hosmer tried his best, okay? He tried his best to undo it. Yeah, I thought this one was not quite as bad. And maybe it was just that I feel like last year was there was a steady stream heading into like the last four or five days. And this year, I think just between the All-Star game, the draft, all of that stuff going on, there was not as much. It was really quiet until kind of, 48 hours beforehand. But we're here. We made it. I still have quite a lot of work to do, but I'm putting it off to talk to you guys, and I'm happy to be doing so. We can hop in with our first topic. It's Juan Soto going to San Diego. This was the big deal. This was the holdup to a lot of the trade deadline. It broke, I don't know what, semi-early this morning that it seemed like it was about to happen, maybe 11, somewhere in the 11 to 12 hour. As I mentioned with Hosmer, it was somewhat held up. But it turned out that was not an issue. They subbed in Luke Voit for Hosmer, and then he went and accompanied the rest of the prospects who are very young major leaguers. And Juan Soto and Josh Bell are now in Padres Brown. I have a lot of thoughts on this deal, but I'm curious to hear kind of what you guys think overall. Zach, I'll start with you. We had 2 weeks' notice that this was seemingly going to happen, not necessarily to San Diego. I can't really wrap my mind around Juan Soto being traded at all, but how did the Nats do given that it seemed like it had to happen, at least from an ownership perspective there?
Right. I'll hit on. I would say that a lot of the conversations I've had with other baseball paying attention people is whether we can separate this out into a thing that had to happen and move on to saying how did the Nats do versus do we need to judge this decision from the start of whether they should even consider trading Juan Soto and start there. I have been in the camp of we should judge the decision straight down from the top of does it even make sense to be trading 23-year-old Ted Williams equivalent Juan Soto, which is a pretty, you can't get far after that. You're pretty much dead in the water if that's a choice you're making. And so I think if you look at my opinions of this trade, they tend to be much more sour for the Nationals than a lot of people's, which is just a reflection of how good I think Soto is and how impossible it is, I think, for them to really recoup the value, not just of having Juan Soto for 2.5 years, but of the opportunity to potentially keep him longer than that, that they are forfeiting by trading him now. And maybe they think they have no chance of it, although I think that's pretty ridiculous considering the ownership group is going to change. So I just think the opportunity cost that they incur by sending him away now is so large that it would have taken just another superstar coming back, perhaps, maybe would have changed my mind. But as it turns out, they got a very impressive prospect package. If someone traded this for, like, I don't know, a normal good player at the trade deadline, we would be overwhelmed. But as it turns out, like, I don't feel that confident that any of these players are even going to be, like, all-stars in 2026, where I think Juan Soto might still be the best hitter in baseball in 2032. So I'm not that swayed, no matter how good the prospect package is, which, you know, all of these prospects are good. It's just, it is basically a non-starter when you start with Juan Soto.
Yeah, and I would add that, oh, by the way, they also traded Josh Bell here, and I felt like he was one of the better available hitters on the open market, so I was a little surprised to see him kind of get tossed into this deal almost as an afterthought.
I mean, there's a lot of parts I can't get over. I do side with you, Zach, on the way to evaluate this deal, because I don't... Well, first of all, I don't understand the imperative to trade Juan Soto in any capacity. RJ and I talked about this last week where, you know, I said, like you did, like, if I'm an incoming owner, I want the chance to extend Juan Soto. And I understand he turned down a lot of money, but he did it. He turned down a lot of money for a lot of years instead of just, like, a 10 to 12 year term, right? It was 15. That's a big difference when you're talking that kind of money over that many years. And so I would like the chance to have Juan Soto and to make him a national, as you said, like Ted Williams. This is a guy who should have a statue outside Nationals Park. I don't know how to judge this in any other context than it shouldn't have happened, because this is a... How often do you have a 23-year-old future Hall of Famer that you know is going to be, you know, pending injury, is going to be a future Hall of Famer? I don't know how to process that on a normal scale. Not right? Often. I mean, that's... Go ahead, RJ.
No, I was going to say, not often. I mean, he is... He's elite, right? I mean, you look at his season this year, this is the worst season he's had during the pandemic era. And what that entails is a 408 on base percentage, 485 slugging percentage.
So one.
And, you know, yeah. Far more walks and strikeouts. I mean, we're talking about just one of the best hitters in the game, period. And like you said, he's 23. He's on a Hall of Fame track. He has 2+ years of team control remaining. And yeah, it's almost unheard of for a player of this youth, this kind of team control profile, and also this established track record to get dealt at this point in their career.
Yeah, and I think the constant joke we always see with Juan Soto in pretty much any context is, like, how old are the guys that, you know, he's facing or that he's... And, like, true to form, Mackenzie Gore, 4 months younger than him. That's it. Like, that's the big, you know, you are still dreaming on the potential, which is lower, of this other guy who's 4 months younger. I mean, it's just unfathomable that any of these guys are going to be as good as he is by the time they're 23. And granted, they're, you know, the Nationals are going to get 6-7 years of play out of these guys. But when I ran the numbers earlier of just, you know, what a basic projection system thinks Soto is going to do for 2.5 years, he's basically going to be worth Tim Anderson's entire career so far by the time this contract runs out. And, like, none of these guys are going to be as good as Tim Anderson, most likely. That's just the... unlikely.
So even if you were going to say, okay, let's look at this from a perspective of they had, you know... Let's say you're Mike Rizzo, where... I guess he even said, I didn't have to trade it. I set a benchmark, essentially, and San Diego passed it. Right, but let's say that you know, ownership said, you should be trading Juan Soto because we can't sign him long term, and so we're looking to maximize value. How did he do on maximizing value, RJ?
Yeah, well, to run down the names he received, and we're just focusing on the minor league talent, because I don't think anyone is going to consider Luke Voit to be essential to this trade. He received C.J. Abrams, Mackenzie Gore, Robert Hassel III, James Wood, and I had not seen this name pronounced, so apologies if I butcher it, but Jarlin,
either that or
Sasana,
Harlan, I would assume.
I think that's how you say his name. Other. That's the phonetic version?
Yeah.
Or Harlan, like... Yeah, Harlan the Marlin. So, yeah. So, you know, Abrams and Gore, they've been around the top prospect list their entire careers. They both already played in the majors, and they both had somewhat disappointing seasons in the majors. You know, Abrams, I heard from evaluators coming into this year about his swing decisions, about his quality of contact, and what has sabotaged him so far in his big league career. His swing decisions and his quality of contact. He chased more than 40% of the time, had an average exit velocity in the mid-80s, which is not very good. He's obviously fast. He's young. He doesn't have a ton of experience above A-ball. You know, even including last year, he's already played more games in the majors than he played in either Double-A or Triple-A. So you would think, maybe with some more repetitions against advanced pitching, he could grow into the upside that we thought he had when I think almost all of us considered him to be a top 10 to top 15 prospect. With Gore, you know, he's currently out with an injured elbow, which is concerning. He's battled the yips based on reports in the past. And, you know, I don't know that he really has a narrow outcome outcome range here. I think that if he told me he became a mid-rotation starter, I'd buy it. If he told me he became a little bit more than that, I'd buy it. If he told me that he had to move to the bullpen or that he... you know, this elbow issue proved to be more serious than that, I would buy it. Just, you know, it's a wide range of outcomes. So I don't know how you necessarily feel comfortable with, you know, one particular branch of that more so than the others. And then with the prospects, I'll run through those really quickly. Hassel, former first-round pick. The Padres are really high on him in his draft year. He can really hit. Questions are, number one, can he tap into his raw power? And number two, can he stay in center field? Because if he has to move to a corner, that puts more of an emphasis on him tapping into his pop. Wood is a 6'7" guy. He's got huge raw power. He runs better than you think. And while the concerns on him in his draft year were about a swing and miss and strikeout rates, he's struck out in fewer than 20% of his plate appearances this season. So that seems encouraging. And then Sasana, 18-year-old big righty, promising fastball, breaking ball combination. Seems like if he were in the draft this year, he probably would have been, you know, a first round pick. Somewhere in that 10 to 15 range because, you know, he is an 18-year-old right-hander. But, you know, he seems really promising. And the problem is he's a 18-year-old right-hander, and he's only pitched in the Complex League. And we kind of know that, again, there's a wide range of outcomes there. Maybe he becomes number one or number two starter,
unfair,
or maybe we never even see him in the majors.
You know, Tyler Kolek was like a 6'8", you know, 18-year-old right-hander who threw 100 miles an hour, too. Right, he was the second overall pick in the draft, but he didn't go anywhere. That's health issues, but
yeah,
health issues happen to pitchers, and especially pitchers who throw, you know, 98 to 102 at that age. I think so. I mean, Susana definitely exciting. I think Jarrett Seidler for us in our write up said, you know, one of if not the best, you know, pitching prospect under 18 in the minors right now, but. You know, there's a lot of risk that comes with that. I'm really interested in Abrams and Gore in that I think they're two of the riskiest, like, high-level prospected major leaguers that we've had in recent memories. Like, C.J. Abrams was in BP's top 10 in the 101 before this season, but he hadn't played a ton. He had excelled when he had played, but he hadn't played a ton because he broke his leg. At one point he missed a lot of time, and the Padres just shoved him really quickly through the minors, you know, when he was healthy. So we didn't have a ton of like track record of him at various levels. And then they called him up. And as you mentioned, he struggled and why he struggled, but like, you know, I think there's more risk than you with him than you'd get in a normal top 10 prospect. I think that's fair to say. And then Gore, you know, you mentioned he had the yips. He started this year, he was throwing 97. He was looking great. He started fading really quickly once he kind of surpassed his prior innings totals. They had just put him in the bullpen prior to his elbow barking. So I think that was to save him, you know, innings more than anything. I don't think it was a reflection on his standing. But I don't know, Zach, even though I'm asking you to do what you said, like, you shouldn't do in terms of how to view these things, like, how do you reconcile those leading this? And then to RJ's point from before, Josh Bell is in here. Josh Bell has a 152 OPS plus. That's 6 points behind Juan Soto right now. He's a switch hitter. He plays a decent first base. This guy seems to be in here for free.
Yeah, I don't understand the Nationals' insistence on the Trey Turner Memorial throw-in, but the thing I can't really get around with the deal is sort of exactly what you're talking about, which is none of these guys are sure things. Not even like sure thing major league regulars. I mean, I actually wrote in my write-up, and I'm not a scout. I know nothing. I just read things.
I think that's right.
It
RJ?
Seems to me like Hassel might be the most sure thing regular. And he's,
yeah, I mean, you know, the hit toll gives him a wider margin of error, but I would also add, you know, the power and defense concerns could make him just a second division type.
Right. Which is, and that's sort of my problem with it, is that seems to be the highest floor of the bunch, just because of kind of everything with Abrams that we don't know. And actually my, kind of bleak Nationals fans, cover your ears, assessment of Abrams is, what if this
I was going to say, in honor of Ben Carsley, fancy dog D. Gordon.
We thought it was good. Can we have another? yeah, it just feels like the Nationals have done well with some risky prospects up until, I don't know, 2 years ago. So it's not that the organization is incapable of making that work, but when you're trading Juan Soto, and this is a tricky needle to thread that I'm about to attempt to, but if you're trading Juan Soto, I would probably prioritize doing it in an off season so you would have a better menu of actual young stars who are already established to trade for. Because you want to be sure you're at least getting something. And, you know, I wouldn't say the Mookie Betts deal worked out great for the Red Sox. The Cleveland deal for Lindor is actually working out okay with Andrés Giménez, but he wasn't a star at the time. But I think something in an offseason gives you a better chance to pull someone's best young player off the team, which is just not something you're going to do with a contender during a season and during a pennant race. So it makes it tougher because you then wouldn't trade Juan Soto for 3 pennant races. He'd be down to 2. But I don't think you can have this
postseason's worth of Juan Soto out of this trade
and no one that you're sure of.
No, no, no. I'm saying, did the Nationals get the return to justify that?
Yeah. Yeah.
The Padres? Yeah.
So, I mean, what's the difference, right? If you give up a postseason in terms of your value coming back, you're not getting it. I don't know that you can get it. And to be clear, like, I saw people saying, you know, Rizzo did as well as could have been expected if you accept kind of the circumstances. And I suppose that's fair because I don't think the Dodgers are, whatever the Dodgers could have packaged, I don't know that it's, I think I'd be saying the same things. You know what I mean? I might be saying them happier as a Dodgers fan, but like, I think from the national side, like, I don't think you get a different bucket of risk, but not necessarily a better one in terms of what you're giving up. I could talk myself into saying like St. Louis could maybe give you the best, like, if they were willing to talk Carlson and Gorman and Walker and Wynn and Grichefo and Hence or something.
Right.
And that's exactly the type of off-season sort of conversation I could see picking up more traction.
Literally, because think about it. If you're St. Louis, you need a center fielder with Harrison Bader out. Carlson had been their center fielder. So, you know, trading him creates another hole literally up the middle of the field. So that would have been something that may have been available to them in the off-season that was not available to them now.
No, exactly. And again, Louis's like, I guess,
competitive aspirations.
Look, like I said, I'm never going to like this because... Like, I can't emphasize enough that he should have a statue outside of Nats Park. You know what I mean? Like, there are so few guys who are worthy of statues outside of a stadium. Like, he should have been here his whole career. He won a title with the team already. Like, he's Ted Williams, as Zach said. Like, I cannot wrap my head around this. I can't believe they traded him. It really is like
traded
it really
by
is, and I
birthday.
Don't I really
fathom.
Struggle to accept that like a new owner like you're saving the new ownership. You know what? Like new ownership bought the Marlins and then strip mined that team and no one gave a shit. What make that new ownership's problem? I don't understand why the Lerners are doing anyone the favor.
Right. Yeah, it's a fair point. And it's kind of funny
yes,
because of all the ownership
point.
Groups, I feel like they're the ones whose relationship with Scott Boras has been most beneficial and also most publicized. Remember, it was Boras who supposedly, we're going off public reporting here, supposedly told him years and years ago to tank for Bryce Harper and Steven Strasburg. So, of course, I don't think he used their names. I think he just said, you know, tank and
so,
get these high draft picks, whatever.
What
they're
does...
Kind of, they don't get credit for it, but they're kind of the progenitors
what is this?
Of the whole
obviously,
tanking mindset.
So I don't even know where to go. Does... Sure, yeah, right, yeah.
I think you're asking, what does this do for the Nationals' future? Am I right? Because my point would be, the farm system is improved, but I think they may have the most boom or bust top of a
Brady
farm
House
system
and...
in the entire majors. I mean, you look at the names who... are not just in this trade, but you look at the names who are already in that system. Cade Cavalli has struggled in AAA.
Yeah.
I think he's starting to get it together. Brady House,
his,
Elijah
and now
Green,
as we talked about
drafted,
his IMG teammate,
you could tell me he becomes
James
the best
Wood.
Player in the draft, I'd believe it. You could tell me he never reaches the majors, I'd believe it. There you go, Jackson Rutledge. I mean, there are just a lot of boom or bust types in the system, and you could say, hey, you know, if your player development system's good, your player development staff, excuse me, is good, they might have some superstars on this roster or in this farm system. They might have some all-star types. The problem is, does anyone believe that the Nationals development staff and system are good? I mean, who was the last guy they developed? And the answer, of course, is Juan Soto. And he was in the majors before he was 20. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting few years in D.C., just not at the big league level.
I would say my parting thought on the Nationals is... So the thought kind of, if you believe that the Nationals had to do this and you divorce it a little bit from the ownership situation, the baseball reasoning is you don't want them to become the Angels where they waste a player's prime because they can't field the team around him. But my reaction to that is a lot of the guys they just traded for, you know, they had 2.5 years to convince Juan Soto to stay that, you know, they were worth taking the extension for
right,
and to put a team
right.
around him that made it worth it. And you know how when the Padres got all these guys, they just traded them? Like within the last year and a half. You know, and so what are you doing in trading away Juan Soto instead of, I don't know, throwing an extra $400,000 or something at your scouting and development system to try to do whatever the Padres are doing?
It's not even clear the Padres are good at
so
player development.
It's ridiculous to give up
to
on
be
Juan
clear.
Soto
like,
over just like
well,
trying
good at
to figure
acquisition,
out how to find better young players.
That's fair, but like the player development part for the Padres,
the,
I mean, again,
part,
like Abrams hasn't really panned out. Gore is a question mark. Like, who are the homegrown? There's Tatis, who was kind of the Soto of the Padres, and then they got Cronenworth in a trade from the Rays. Grisham blossomed at the major league level with them. That was a trade. Like, they, you know, they, I don't know. They just have, like, a weird kind of... They're very, like, acquired from other teams more than homegrown in general.
Yeah.
No, yeah, I think Preller, yes. And even back to his days with the Rangers, yes. It's not necessarily that they're great at development. It's that they are great at finding guys who are really appealing right before they trade them.
It's easy, and it's easier to find appealing prospects than it is to find
elite players. And say, like, what does this do for San Diego? You know, we saw the take going around that was like, players. This doesn't really change the dynamic of the NL West, right? The Dodgers are ahead by around 12 games right now. I don't think this changes the NL West race. I don't mean to sound like overconfident, but it just doesn't seem likely to. This does make a difference for the playoffs and obviously, you know, 2023 and beyond. So what does this do for the Padres? I mean, you insert Josh Bell and Juan Soto into a lineup that frankly was not great. To this point, what does this do for them? And then we can also talk, obviously they acquired Josh Hader. They acquired Brandon Drury. So, let's fold all of that into the discussion and where the Padres sit after, you know, the last few days of the trade deadline.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. Doesn't change the outlook of the National League West for this season. Going forward, we'll see. But for now, I would agree that it's not going to, you know, reduce that gap between the two teams enough for it to matter. That said, you know, the postseason does matter. And now with the wild card round being a best of three, where the better team hosts all three games, there is incentive to be that superior team, right? To be the first wild card. And I think the Padres are well positioned for that. Additionally, I think they're well positioned for the future. I mean, they have a core now that's built around Fernando Tatis Jr., Manny Machado, and Juan Soto. That is probably a future MVP, perhaps the current MVP, and a guy who, again, you're probably looking at as a future MVP. I mean, that's a heck of a core to build around. You mentioned some of the other pieces they folded in. Already what they have on the books, I mean, gosh, it's a really good team. And it also really raises the excitement level. And one point that I don't think it's made enough is that baseball is part of the entertainment industry. And anytime you can field the best possible product and energize your fan base, those should be priorities. And AJ Preller is really good at least half that and arguably good at both of those things. And I think that's a great thing for San Diego. And I think it's a great thing for baseball as a whole, because a decade ago, the Padres victory was what? Kristen Orfia, Chase Headley, and I don't even know who the other part would be. And that just kind of proves the point. Maybe cool. I don't even know. Will Venable is probably the other one 10 years ago. So there you go. Would you rather have that three or this three? I think we know the answer.
Yeah, I think this is just a – look, they're not going to catch the Dodgers this year. Do they have a better chance at beating them in the next 2 years? I guess, but probably not that much better. But – they don't need to beat the Dodgers in the regular season for this to be a huge success. We can have just a great two-team battle that one team always wins, like the Yankees and the Red Sox back in the early 2000s. The playoffs produce the drama eventually, and the Padres are going to be in a great position to take them on in the playoffs. I mean, this is just a ridiculous set of stars. It is... just, I mean, it brings to mind those early 2000s Red Sox with just a barrage of big personalities, or the 90s Cleveland teams just with more defense. That is the type of team that San Diego suddenly has now. And they kind of had that before, and the rotation wasn't any good. Now they fixed the rotation. The lineup isn't very good with Tatis out. Now they've added Juan Soto to solve that problem. So I don't know when they pull it all together what exactly it looks like, but it sure seems like it should add up to a 95-ish win team that could be absolutely terrifying in the playoffs. And to rope in the Josh Hader point, you know, I actually kind of liked that deal a little bit better for the Brewers, who had a surplus of relief arms and used it to kind of bulk up some other things. But, you know, Josh Hader has basically had one bad month in the history of his career, and it is the most recent month. But I think there's, you know, the odds are that he's going to be okay and that he's going to be a useful closer for a team that has sort of fudged around with a whole bunch of relief pitchers who haven't stuck as the closer ever since, I guess, Mark Melanson.
Luis Garcia was next in line, I think.
And so I think that's a worthwhile risk of taking. They didn't seem committed to Taylor Rogers. You know, they maybe will... Yeah, they might regret a little bit Esteury Ruiz, although his quality of contact isn't great either. So I'm pretty bullish on that move, and I don't see a lot of downside there. So as for Brandon Drury, I don't know. He'll play any position that someone else can't play, which, oh, good. It's better than I don't know who they've been rolling out in that role, but he can't be much worse than what they've been doing.
Yeah, I like the Drury addition for what it is. You know, he's got some pretty solid ball tracking data, and you know, it's a nice story as well. Someone's fond of that. I think I was lower, on Milwaukee's return and the Hader deal than either of y'all. And I really just had 3 points. Number one, if you look at Hader's pitch quality, you know, there's no discernible difference between July and the months prior when he was really good. Number two, I get what Zach's saying. Like, I get it from Milwaukee. I get that the idea that, you know, Rogers might approximate or even, you know, succeed Hader's production the rest of the way, because that's just the way relievers work over small samples. But this still just feels light for me, because for one thing, Lamet is a non-tender candidate. You know, he's already amassed close to 5 years of service time. He's going to be making almost $5 million next year. He's been a mess. I'm not sure they're going to keep him beyond this year unless they really work with him quickly and get things figured out. And then the other two, Ruiz and Robert Gasser, who we haven't mentioned yet. As Zach said, there are questions about Ruiz's bat. He might just end up being a fun end-of-bench type who could really run and perhaps really play center field. Gasser is actually the most interesting long-term piece for me, because he kind of fits what Milwaukee does best with the funky arm actions and, you know, the weird spin and all. You know, he's a little lefty. He has a low release point. You know, I could see him actually playing up in the system, and he's the only reason I hesitate to say this could look decent for Milwaukee. Well, that and also the reliever sample size thing I just mentioned, but for me, I think this is just a slam dunk one for the Padres. I don't see any reason. I don't see any reason that they're going to come to regret this, because even Gasser, I don't think he would have had the same success, if he does have success in San Diego, that he will have in that Milwaukee system. I just think he's really tailored for them.
I don't know. I can see both sides of this. I thought it was a fun trade. Like you just don't see two teams trade their closers very often. Although I guess arguably San Diego also did this with Emilio Pagan when the season started for Taylor Rogers. So maybe it's just a Preller thing. But I just thought it was kind of a fun challenge trade. And some of the reason I like it for the Brewers so much is that they are so good at fixing guys or getting the most out of guys, even if they're already pretty good. So that was one thing. You know, Drury doesn't necessarily have to move the needle, but I just wanted to point to something that Ginny mentioned in our transaction analysis on this, just with Juan Soto fitting in the lineup. Like the guys who had played right field for the Padres were Nomar Mazara, Jose Azucar, and Will Myers. They had the most games in right field for the Padres, 44, 40, and 33 respectively. The top DRC plus for them was 84. That belonged to Nomar Mazara. Juan Soto's at 154. So it's almost doubling their right field production. And then on top of that, again, you throw in Josh Bell, that's an Eric Hosmer / Luke Voit replacement. He's at 138 DRC plus, and Brandon Drury's at 118. I guess the other of Hosmer and Voit were at DH, but that's, you know, that's an upgrade there. And again, he can stand anywhere on the field. You can, you know, move Ha-Seong Kim or Jake Cronenworth around as needed. I don't know. This is a scary lineup with Tatis back, and it seems like he's coming back soon. I'll just run it down as Ginny laid out. Tatis, Soto, Machado, Bell, Profar, who people might underrate. He's a 120 DRC plus this year. Brandon Drury, Kim / Cronenworth at second base, Austin Nola behind the plate, and Trent Grisham, who has had a really bad year, but he's your nine hitter. That's not too shabby. I mean, that's
easier to swallow. Yeah.
That's stunningly good. The last thing I will say before we depart this topic and these teams is, do the Padres need to extend him for this to work out for them? Soto is going to make,
I don't think so. No.
Something in the range of 55 to 60 million over the next 2 years in arbitration. But they could obviously, you know, do a 2-year deal that covers his arb years or something like that. So it's not like he's cheap. He's cheap for what he is at that rate, but it's still not inexpensive. But neither of you think they need to extend. Do either of you have a sense that, do you think they will?
I have no idea. I would say they have a lot of money coming off the books, and at this point, it's hard to bet against Perler if he really wants to keep him, right? But no, I don't think they have to extend him for this deal to look good. Again, any chance you get at 3 playoff runs with one of the best players in the game, I mean, gosh, you would take that. You would take that if you had him for 6 years or 7 years, right? If you were guaranteed 3 playoff runs of him, you'd have to feel pretty good about your chances of making a deep run at least once or twice, right?
Yeah, I would say it would be fun as hell if they extend him. And I think whatever magic AJ Preller has worked to get the Padres to spend this much in the past few years, maybe there's more where that came from. Maybe they're going to drop $500 million on him next week. I really don't know. But I think getting 3 potential playoff runs for a team that is already so invested is, that's a win from step one. And if they get to 2024 and find that they can keep him around.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I tend to think they will extend him just because I think, you know, on some level what he's looking for, right? We know what he's rejected. And I don't know if you give up that haul to get someone without the intention to extend. Obviously, it takes two to reach an extension, but I do think I do think that they're going into this with designs on extending him, knowing full well what the cost is, you know, or you know, being willing to extend into that range of what the cost, you know, is anticipated as. So I was planning to move on to our second topic, but I do want to drop some breaking news here. I don't know if either of you saw this. The Dodgers just announced that Vin Scully has passed away at the age of 94. So that is, yeah, obviously I'm a Dodgers fan. I grew up, he was the only announcer I grew up listening, you know, he was the voice of baseball most of my life. As soon as MLB, like game day radio, you know, audio came into being, and MLB TV and extra innings and things like that. Just a tremendous loss. Obviously, he's been retired for several years, handing the torch to Joe Davis, but had been, you know, had spent, I think, 63 years in the organization, something like that. I don't know. I'm at a little bit of a loss for words, but that is that the just came across my timeline and across the Dodgers broadcast, which I have on in the background. Yeah, just a stunning announcement. I guess as stunning as one can be for someone being 94 and passing away, I suppose. I don't know if either of you have any Vin Scully thoughts.
No, he was an all-time great. And obviously, like you said, he spanned from Jackie Robinson to Clayton Kershaw. It's a heck of a career, heck of a life.
Yeah, I think it's just when you go back and realize how many times you have heard his voice on broadcasts from before you were born, while you were a baseball fan, he was pretty.
Yeah, obviously some of the most famous calls of all time had done non Dodger games as well as, he was a national broadcaster for quite a while. That's just, again, as surprising as one can be for a 94-year-old. I will move on to our second topic at this point. This is a few days old. I thought this was the breaking of the dam at the time, but it was a bit quiet after this for a while. But the Mariners went all in, on this season, at least to a point that they weren't to before, and acquired Luis Castillo from the Reds. They moved Noelvi Marte and Edwin Arroyo, Levi Stout, and I know there's one other prospect who's Andrew Moore, right. Thank you.
Andrew Moore.
And not the Andrew Moore you're thinking of, I'm guessing. And not the... Yeah.
No, this
was a very big deal. I don't know. I saw people... I thought this was a heavy price to pay for Luis Castillo, but also what Luis Castillo is worth, especially to a team like Seattle, who hasn't made the playoffs since 2001. They are currently in possession of a wild... They were, I think, third in the wild card at that point. They now are in possession of the second wild card, three games back of the Blue Jays. This was a real price to pay in prospects, but I loved this move for Seattle, personally. Zach, I don't know where it landed for you.
I like it for Seattle. I think the Reds did actually, extremely well did on really this deal. Well. I thought the Reds did a great job at the deadline, which is a vast difference from the offseason when I thought they were terrible. But this deadline worked out really well for them. They had two of the three best starting pitchers who ended up moving, and they leveraged it really, really well. But for the Mariners, I think it's a worthwhile price, assuming Noelvi Marte doesn't turn into like Carlos Correa or something. I think I saw someone reference this. I think it might have been Michael Bauman at The Ringer. Just the lineage of young team hits its upswing and in the middle of its first year of contention gets a true number one, you know, whether it's the Blue Jays with David Price or a bunch of other teams that have done this. I do enjoy that particular brand of trade, and that is what the Mariners did here. They went and got Luis Castillo, who I find extremely aesthetically pleasing to watch because he sort of reminds me of like Pedro Martinez light with that changeup and the two different fastball shapes. So I'm into the trade. It is a little odd in that Seattle probably had bigger needs on the bat side than in the rotation side, but it's okay. The Mariners are trying to break their playoff drought. Whatever helps will help. And it sure feels like, as I wrote in a column I just filed, I do think that the AL playoff picture feels pretty solidified at this point. I think the teams that are in the spots right now made themselves stronger, and the teams that are chasing them did pretty much nothing good. So I feel, knock on all the wood, but I feel good about the Mariners, which famous last words, but the Mariners did help themselves with this, and I think it, Castillo's just an exciting player.
Yeah, and I would say this is the kind of trade you make when you haven't made the playoffs in 20 years. This almost feels like it was ripped out of the early 2000s trade market because it's absurd and unusual nowadays to see teams trade this much prospect talent for, you know, a year and a half of a starting pitcher, albeit a really good one, and albeit one who has mostly been durable in his career. Of course, he did miss some time earlier this year with shoulder issues, but knock on wood on that front, I suppose. I want to talk about the Reds part of this because I did really like this trade, and I did really like their deadline, and I did also favorably compare and contrast this to their offseason, where it looked like they were going to go just full-out salary dump mode without really concerning themselves with the return or the optics or any of that. This was a nice recovery, and Marte is pretty interesting. I think he's another guy who is universally top 15 on these lists. You know, he might have to move off shortstop, but he has big time power, and you know, he walks, he keeps his strikeout rate in check. He's young for his league, but the production's there. You know, even if he moves to third base, you could foresee him growing into an offensive star. Now, maybe he falls a little short of that or what have you, but it's a good profile. With Arroyo, I know him from the draft days, and I know he had a lot of supporters because he was extremely young. He was clearly going to stick at shortstop, and he had some of the raw ingredients offensively to project some level of production from him at the plate. And to his credit, he's really held his own as well, despite being, again, about 3 years younger than his league's average competitor. You know, I think that really bodes well for him. I think that's, you know, a really encouraging sign. So I think those two alone are probably top 50 prospects, certainly top 100, and that's a heck of a get. And then, you know, Stout and Moore, they're both probably bullpen arms. Moore is 100% a bullpen arm, throws really hard. If he can keep his walks in check, potentially a late-inning reliever. Stout, still starting games, but I think it's probably more likely than not he's going to end up in the bullpen as well, and we'll see what that looks like when it gets to that point. But, you know, just getting Marte and Arroyo is a really nice haul, I think, for the Reds.
Yeah, I agree. We did both on our midseason list. We had both Arroyo and Marte on that list. I think Marte at 28 and Arroyo, I'm not remembering exactly, I think maybe 48.
You had probably like five different Red shortstops on that list or close to it, because they have a lot of shortstop prospects.
Yeah, I don't think we mentioned the return for Drury, but it was Victor Acosta, who was a shortstop from the Padres system. So, yeah, they...
And Molly netted Spear.
Right, Spencer Steer. Yeah. Which we'll touch on in a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. The Reds cleaned up, and I was not really expecting it, but I thought they did a great job kind of across the board on their trades. They had a lot of guys to move. They moved, I think, almost all of them. And I thought they did really well on all the returns. So one thing I want to come back to on Castillo, you know, Zach mentioned that they needed probably more help in the lineup. I think that's true. They did make some minor moves today to kind of address that. They picked up Jake Lamb from the Dodgers. They had a couple other small things, but the one thing I'll say about their pitching is their pitching had been very good, but it also relied on Logan Gilbert, who's going to be in a career high in innings pitched. George Kirby already, I think, is in a career high for innings pitched. Chris Flexen had been better of late, but, you know, more of a back-end kind of guy. Marco Gonzalez, better in a back-end role where he is now with Gilbert and Ray and Kirby. Robbie Ray has been kind of up and down. It seems like he's on the upswing a little bit, got his velocity back, I think, for the second time this year. But I think Castillo knocking those guys all down a slot in the rotation is not to be overlooked. And if anyone gets hurt, I mean, I think Tommy Malone was their sixth starter, right? So, like, if anyone gets hurt or needs to miss time or they need to skip a start for Kirby or someone like that, all of a sudden you're in Tommy Malone territory. And I think you're right, Zach, that the playoff picture is pretty solidified, but there also is a big I mean, I don't know. There are advantages to moving up among the three wild cards. And I don't know. I just thought it was important. The lack of depth that they had in terms of starting pitching was pretty substantial to me, and I really liked what Castillo did in that capacity.
Yeah, and also, you know, again, we mentioned the changes to the wild card format, best of three series. It's going to be tough to beat Castillo, Gilbert, and Ray. To beat two of them in a three-game span. I mean, the Mariners here may have actually not only punched their tickets to an extra round, but who knows? Maybe they end up in the ALCS if, you know, those three are pitching up to their capabilities
right
in October.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to point out, I don't know what else they would have thrown in at this point, but, like, I thought Drury would have been a really good fit for Seattle, who's not getting much out of Adam Frazier and you know, Dylan Moore and those types of guys. Again, he can kind of stand, although Abraham Toro not performing well. So I thought Drury was like a natural fit to go with Castillo. Obviously ends up in San Diego instead. But yeah, I still liked that for Seattle. I agree that they needed help in the lineup too. Any other thoughts on what Seattle did, obviously with Castillo a few days ago or today, or I guess the Reds, since we're kind of grouping them together in this one? Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of a win now move, the New York Yankees, they had acquired Andrew Benintendi already a few days ago, but the big move of this deadline was securing Frankie Montas and Lou Trevino from the Oakland Athletics. They sent what, three pitching prospects and a bat. I'm going off the top of my head here, but it was Ken Waldachuk was the big name, J.P. Sears, Cooper Bowman was the infield prospect, and I'm once again forgetting Luis Medina. Thank you, RJ's got me covered. So, Zach, what did you make of this move for the Yankees, and did it change with the last move they made at the end of the day, the one move I haven't mentioned yet? Yeah, go for it.
Yes, that was going to be my entire thing. When they made this move for Montas, I was like, this is awesome. This is a perfect idea. You know, it basically, the Yankees up until a couple weeks ago had been rolling with just a wonderful streak of health and luck in the rotation, where they had had all but two starts, I think, made by their five best guys. That, of course, didn't last. It's not ever going to last in a full season. Luis Severino hit the IL. But I think that Montas could step in, be, you know, knock down your five starters into six if everyone's healthy, and that's a great situation to be in. But as it turns out, the Yankees decided to turn around and trade Jordan Montgomery, who has been extremely solid, and if you look back over the last 2 years, not a whole lot different than Frankie Montas. Worse, but not a whole lot worse. Maybe like a 10% worse type situation. Traded him for Harrison Bader of the Cardinals, center fielder who currently cannot play because of a foot injury. I just don't understand. I don't understand. This means that Domingo Herman, who has been very bad, is going to keep starting games in the interim while Severino's out. They moved Severino to the 60-day IL, so he's not eligible to come back till mid-September. And there's really no confident backstop now if, say, Nestor Cortes has serious regression, or, you know, like we were talking about with the Mariners young guys, he's not as young, but he's never thrown this many major league innings before. Jameson Taillon is not known for his durability. There are a lot of risks in the lower part of this Yankees rotation that when you slotted in Frankie Montas and had Jordan Montgomery as the four, it looked really great. When you slot in Frankie Montas just as a replacement for Jordan Montgomery, it just, I don't know, that's not that inspiring. And, you know, their depth arm behind Domingo Herman was J.P. Sears, who they traded to Oakland. So I just, that one was confusing for me. I think I downgraded that move a lot once they made the Montgomery move, because it just made less sense.
I'm inclined to agree
that.
Because I wrote up the Montas and Trevino acquisition along with Scott Efros. I suppose we should mention they traded Hayden Wesneski to the Cubs for Scott Efros as a reliever. I liked that move because of exactly what you said, dude. It's like, okay, we don't have to talk about Domingo Herman anymore. This is really good. And also, like, you move Jordan Montgomery to that fourth spot in a rotation, you know, a playoff rotation. You feel a lot better with Severino out, with Taillon kind of backsliding and injury prone. And then just, I understand to some degree getting Bader. He's a very, very good defensive center fielder, but they also don't have a huge center field. Like, Aaron Judge has been playing there and has been fine. And so I guess it depends where you're going. You might want a really elite defensive center fielder, and I think Bader can give them that. If he's healthy, not only is he on the IL, he's got plantar fasciitis. So that can really impact, obviously, his foot, his range, things like that.
They're going to have the best center field group on the IL of any team in history.
I will tell you, like, this one, when it came across, really unraveled me a little bit. Like, I just was not prepared for this at all. And, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what I thought was happening. I thought, as soon as this trade happened, I slacked several people on Yahoo and was like, we need to get a Pablo Lopez to the Yankees shell ready. Like, that is what I thought was happening. I thought, oh, this means they're about to acquire some huge name pitcher.
Yeah, RJ, I mean, what was your...
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised too, because like you said, it doesn't necessarily
it's not a clean break, right? I guess I'm still trying to wrap my head around what exactly their plans are with Bader. You know, if you said, oh, he's there to maybe platoon with Benintendi, it would make a little bit of sense because Benintendi's always been worse against lefties, but that doesn't really make sense because they have Hicks, they have Stanton, they have Judge. He said, oh, he's this there for next year. It, again, would make a little bit of sense because, you know, maybe they're looking a year ahead, but it does seem to weaken their current team, and I guess maybe they're just trying to take advantage of having that, you know, sizable lead in the American League East. But yeah, it was a weird one, and it unfortunately, it's going to overshadow a series of otherwise solid moves. I mean, we talked a little bit about Montas, how he's an upgrade. I did like both of the relief acquisitions. You know, F. Frost has been really good. I think he's going to continue to be really good. I think he's going to put himself on a national level that maybe was beyond him while pitching for a rebuilding team. And I think Trevino, well, I know Trevino was one of my favorite under-the-radar arms because he started throwing the sweeping slider earlier this year. The results are really good. It suggests that he should probably throw it more often. And also, you know, his batting average on ground balls is around 400. It's one of the worst in the majors, and that just doesn't seem sustainable. Number one, because we know large numbers like that tend to regress, but also number two, because his exit velocity against on ground balls is pretty close to league average. So, you know, I like basically everything they did with him. I'm a little puzzled by the Montgomery-Bader swap, but who knows? I guess we'll see once Bader gets healthy, if he gets healthy this season.
And I wish I had the answer to that. I really don't. Especially, you know, with the Benintendi acquisition, you know, Zach mentioned Hicks. You have Judge. You have, you know, they traded Joey Gallo to the Dodgers. That was kind of a weird one for me as well. But yeah, I really liked the Trevino Efros acquisitions for the bullpen. I really liked Montas. And now I do feel like it's kind of taken the wind out of my sails on acquiring Montas. I do see him as legitimately better than Jordan Montgomery. I get where you're coming from, Zach, but I do think he's an upgrade there. But not to your point, not a massive one necessarily. And now it's like, well, it does feel like there was a piece coming that never came, you know?
Yeah, and I would note that the center field market was really bad this deadline. And I wonder, you know, if this had happened a little bit before the deadline, like an hour before the deadline, I would have been in Zach's boat and said, oh, he's going somewhere else. Because who was the next best center fielder moved? Was it Jose Siri? Was it Brett Phillips? God. Like, there was not a lot of center field talent on the
Esteri Ruiz.
There you go. There was not a lot of center field talent moved. So from that perspective, if it had happened more than, you know, 2 minutes before the deadline or 2 minutes after, whatever, yeah, it would have made sense as part of a three-way trade or maybe a four-way trade. Who knows? But yeah, it is an interesting one, and I really am curious to see how they use him. I will note, we haven't even addressed the Athletic side of the Montas deal.
Well, I was going to say, let's do that, and then we'll take a quick break because people have been listening to us for almost an hour. But let's talk about what the A's got out of this. Again, four prospects. RJ,
Write them down.
Why don't you walk us through your
take? I'll write them down. We'll go ahead and dismiss Bowman. You know, he's a minor league second baseman. He hasn't hit yet, whatever. Medina is a pure reliever. He's not going to throw enough strikes to start. If you watch his delivery, you will see how he has significant arm drag, and that's just not going to change, I don't think. So he's also out of options entering next spring, so you're probably going to see him in that Oakland A's bullpen sooner than later. And then the two lefties they got, Sears and Waldichuk, I think they're interesting because they really fit what the A's like to do. I pointed out on Twitter that the A's have like three of the 11 lefties with the most horizontal break on their fastballs. And if you look at some of their other lefties on staff, this is a common thing. I think this is an intentional pattern for them. I think it's almost a priority for them. Where I struggle is, okay, you know, these guys really fit what they like. Should you have traded for them using this kind of capital? I mean, you know, Montas is one of the top starters on the market coming into the summer. Clearly the top starter after Castillo went. Is that really, you know, is that really the trade to focus on these guys who you could conceivably get from other organizations for less? I don't know the answer to that, but just to highlight them, I think Sears is actually really interesting, and I think he kind of got overlooked because he was just a reliever for the most part for the Yankees. He has a very undistinct name, and also people probably just haven't heard about him much because he's not a major prospect. But What's interesting about him, from my perspective, is he has this really flat release point to the top of the zone because he's kind of short, and he throws from, you know, the three-quarter slot. And also, by the way, he generates he's 5 foot 11, but he generates 6 foot five worth of extension, which is the distance between the pitching rubber to release point, blah, 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 blah. So it's a tough angle, and also his fastball plays up because of that extension. You get the point. The thing is, he's got a lot of positive underlying indicators, and he has a full arsenal, and I would just think that he's going to get a chance to start, and it wouldn't surprise me at all if he turns out to be like Cole Irvin and Paul Blackburn and, you know, some of these ever ace pitchers who are kind of anonymous nationally but end up being fairly solid. That's just my guess, that if there's one guy in this trade who's going to surprise you, it's going to be him, because I think most people realize Waltachuk is, you know, a decent prospect, and they wouldn't be surprised if he turns out okay. But I think Sears is probably the guy for me who has a chance to really impress from this deal.
Plus, his name sounds like a discount wholesale store, which is perfect for the A's.
There you go.
Yeah, so to your point about kind of acquiring these guys for probably the second best, you know, starting pitcher on the market, I think these are very A's guys in Waldachuk and Sears. Like they fit, you know, I guess who knows how long they'll be in a stadium, but they fit kind of the big stadium, could, you know, less premium stuff in terms of like fastball velocity kind of thing going on, and more like pitchability, you know, 3-4 pitch repertoire, that kind of thing. Whether the A's should be, you know, sending, again, the second best pitcher on the market for guys that the Yankees seem to just like pull up out of the ground and, you know, add a few miles of velocity and then ship out, it does seem unfair in that respect. But I don't know that it changes that the A's kind of got guys that fit their mold. I also don't know that that's right. A compliment for a lot of people, that you want to be the kind of prospect that the A's acquire at this point. I think it's fair to say, like, in their Chapman deal, in amidst all of this teardown, I think their returns have been generally underwhelming.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And to that point, I think I struggle with how much you apply that context to teams acquiring player types they seem to really excel with. You know, if like with Montgomery, he's not a prospect, but he really fits
really
the Cardinals'
does.
Way, right?
Yeah.
He throws strikes, gets ground balls. Perfect. You know, it's like, okay, say the Rays had acquired a guy who has a high exit velocity but hits a lot of ground balls. I guess they did kind of, Christian Bethencourt, excuse me. You know, you give them a little extra benefit of the doubt. Or with Gasser, we talked about how he seems like a really good fit for Milwaukee. You give them a little extra boost in your mind, like, okay, you know, in any other system, this guy would not be as good as he's probably going to be with his team. So I don't know. I'm still working through that in my mind, but I tend to agree that, you know, there is something to be said for a team knowing what they're good at, knowing who fits their system and their ballpark, and then going out there and getting them regardless. But I don't know. It's a very interesting philosophical question that probably should be expanded upon some other time.
Yeah, my question for the A's...
No,
sorry,
please.
Derek, I know you're probably trying to go to break, but my question for the A's remains, who is going to hit the ball?
Yeah.
That's how we should go to break. Because the answer is self-evident. No one. Or, no, Tyler Soderstrom. He might, but everyone else.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. Probably best answered by the dead air that will follow this little break. We're back with episode 231 of Five and Dive, the trade deadline special. Our fourth segment, I want to talk about the Phillies. They linked up twice with the Angels today. Are you counting this as one deal, essentially?
No.
No? You're counting it as two?
No, it's two deals.
I'm counting it as two deals.
They made three you know, significant deals overall. I'll start with the reliever first. They acquired David Robertson for Ben Brown. I don't know if you have hot Ben Brown thoughts, RJ.
No, he just seems like a good arm. Fair enough return on a half.
Yeah, interesting arm. I don't think anything special, but like you said, for probably, 20 to 30 innings of a reliever, that's fine. I'm happy for the Phillies to get Robertson back. They had kind of made a big deal about signing him, and then he, threw five pitches for them, I think, before they had to trade him away a few years ago. So I'm happy to do that. I guess I'll go sequentially. They originally linked up with Los Angeles Angels, sending their probably top three or four prospect, Logan O'Hop or O'Hoppy, I don't know exactly how to say it, to the Angels for Brandon Marsh. I guess let's start there before we get the other one. It was essentially one for one, right? I'm not missing anyone on that. Okay.
It was one for one, yeah.
Yeah, it's one for
okay,
one.
Okay, it is O'Hoppy, thank you.
It's
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Marsh is interesting to me because last year when he came up, he really hit the ball hard, hit a good trajectory, and I bought into him breaking out this year. You know, I thought he could be kind of like their Kyle Tucker, where those underlying indicators suggest, oh, this is going to go really well. And then he comes out this year, and he's not hitting the ball hard at all. He started well.
Not,
his exit
so
velocity.
The Angels.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. His exit velocity is in the 17th percentile among players with 300 plus players, and also he's in the 26th percentile when balls hit 95 miles per hour plus. But, and Craig knows where I'm going with this, I have this theory that players who do not necessarily hit the ball hard but hit it at a good angle tend to be undervalued. You know, we've seen it with Tony Kemp and some others. Do not look at Tony Kemp's baseball reference page right now. Don't ruin my point here. You know, whatever. The point is, it kind of works sometimes. So I'm interested with that with Marsh, but the drawback to him is, of course, the strikeouts, right? You know, he strikes out 36% of the time. It was 35% last year. If he keeps that up, it's probably not going to matter what trajectory it's the ball at because it's just not going to really lead to sustainable success. So long story short, he needs to make more contact.
I would say, so this really, came out of left field in terms of I just didn't foresee the Angels trading Brandon Marsh today.
Nope.
But they
or did. Before Jill Adell, or like, I, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. And it also came out of left field because now he doesn't have to play left field.
There
anymore.
You go. I was
and,
waiting for it.
He can play center field, which if you're going to be a fringy hitter, which he is at the moment, and, I harbor some thought that he might be able to cut down on those strikeouts a little bit, make enough contact to be a league average hitter. Then playing a good center field to go with it is a good addition to keep yourself in the majors, and boy, are the Phillies going to give him a chance to do that, because they have not had a good center fielder in a long time, and they need one. He's going to be asked to play all of the outfield until Bryce Harper comes back. So I think it's an interesting creative solution for the Phillies, honestly, in that he won't be worse than what they had, and he's kind of a, they didn't have to go out and find a rental solution. They found someone who has some value beyond this year too, in theory. So I thought that was a pretty creative solution. O'Hoppy was at the Futures game. I actually have stood next to Logan O'Hoppy in person. I have no insight onto how good he is, but seems like a viable catching candidate, which is an area that the Phillies obviously have covered at the major league level, and I think O'Hoppy is pretty much ready to go. So it made some sense to, if you're going to trade from a decent prospect base, he seemed like the one who could go for them.
Yeah, and also if you have reservations about Marsh actually making more contact, then I think this is a good return and a good exit point for the rest of the league catches on, because you're right, O'Hoppy's a solid catching prospect, might make his major league debut later this year. At worst case, you're talking next year, and who knows? It's going to be interesting to see how Marsh does in Philadelphia, but I think you have to be content with this if you are going to
pun on him at this point in his career.
Yeah, I would say I was not expecting this at all. It's a little bit weird, but what I like for the Phillies is they cut Odubel Herrera. They were one of the worst. The production they got out of center field was one of the worst in the league. And they had cycled through a bunch of guys, one of whom we'll touch on in a minute. But, they had gotten nothing out of center field, including defense in a lot of ways. And I think Marsh can at least give them that. And I actually think, in terms of development at the major league level, this is not a bad landing spot for Marsh and what he can do. Again, he can hit it decently hard. The angles aren't great, as is my understanding. I'm sure RJ can correct me, but I think he hits it very flat or on the ground in a lot of instances. And Kevin Long is the hitting coach in Philadelphia now. He's been multiple places. You might remember he was in New York when Marlon Byrd was there and started kind of the catch it out front, elevate kind of thing. He was in D.C. And helped some hitters there. He's very patience and power oriented in a lot of ways. Alec Baum has gone through kind of a lot at the major league level over the last year plus, but is really on fire stinging the ball right now. His big thing was hitting the ball into the ground a lot. I don't think he's solved that, but he certainly hits it very hard. There have been a number of hitters in Philly this year who have kind of taken some steps forward. So I don't know. Am I often in seeing that that's kind of not a bad landing spot for someone with Marsh's skill set? I don't know. So I liked it from that perspective. From the Angels' perspective, I don't know what they're doing. Again, sure, fine. Ohapi is close to ready. Max Stassi is their catcher right now. It's fine, I guess. I don't know. It just seems weird to quit on... It just seems weird to kind of quit on Marsh at this point already. But, I guess it's fine. He hasn't been good, so I guess I can't criticize it from that perspective. The other deal that the Phillies made, again, with the Angels, was acquiring Noah Syndergaard. They sent Mickey Moniak, who was one of the failed center fielders I talked about in Philly, and a minor leaguer, minor league outfielder named Yadiel Sanchez. Do you have any Yadiel Sanchez dirt for us, RJ? Okay.
Not really. I wanted to focus on Syndergaard because I think when you hear that name, you think of the fire-breathing dragon he was with the Mets earlier in his career. He's not that guy anymore. He's more of a mid-90s sinker and changeup pitcher. And to be fair, he's had success with that this season in his first full season since 2019. And I think he's a decent addition for the Phillies, and it's going to be interesting to see how he works in that division now that he's not exactly the guy he was when he came up.
I got to say, Moniak for Syndergaard is just headline news to the guy who just woke up from a coma in 2016. But this is another one where, I love all of this for the Phillies, to be honest. I don't see any part of this that the Angels did well in, really. Ohapi's a fine player, but I don't really know why they needed to trade Brandon Marsh. And having a pitcher who is I imagine at least fairly in demand, if you're the Angels, they just keep going through this. We'll talk about another deal they made in a second, which makes even less sense. But if you're the Angels, why are you recycling through these guys who we are pretty confident cannot hack it at the big league level? At least be the Pirates with Jose Quintana and just get some far away guy who you might be able to find something in.
Sanchez is kind of that, though. He does hit the ball hard, and he's 21. So
maybe he's that. But Mickey Moniak is your return for your big deadline piece? I don't get it. The guy has, he has been so bad at the major league level, so bad. His WRC plus is negative in this year and last year.
Yeah, but to be fair, he has a chance.
Well, here's the other part. Do you think the Angels are going to turn him around? What have the Angels done?
No, of course not. No, you're right. I try to look for the upside here. I do think he has a chance to be a reserve outfielder, but I agree. Look, if you're sitting here trying to find
this was a salary dump. Some silver lining. This was a salary dump. They paid Noah Syndergaard $22 million this year. They wanted to get out from whatever they owed him. What was it, $9 million or something like that, probably.
Yeah, something like that at this point.
They called Dave Dombrowski and said, "You want this?"
They should have. You know what they should have done here? They should have made this a single trade.
Here's the thing. I actually think like the fact that he's like the sinker slider or sorry sinker changeup version of himself. That's so much more the Phillies shit of late. Like they went and got Kyle Gibson last year. They're not getting fire breathing pitchers. You know what I mean? Like flamethrowers at this point. Like this is the kind of guy that they go get apparently. And you know what? They needed another arm. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, you're right. You want someone to put the ball in play against this defense if you're the Phillies. Absolutely. I guess the infield's a little bit better. Bryson Stott is playing more regularly. Gene Segura, I think, is coming back soonish. Stott, one of these guys, by the way, who's flashed a little power and stuff, I think, under the tutelage of Long as well. But, yeah, and again, I don't want to gloss over Robertson. They really needed more... more bullpen help. I guess I should say like, the bullpen's actually been pretty good on the whole. They've gotten like really good innings out of like Andrew Bellotti and guys like that. But they kept pitching Jairus Familia, and they DFA'd him today. And I think Dombrowski did that just so Rob Thompson would stop pitching him. I think it was a little bit like the Moneyball move. What's that?
Otherwise, he had to fire Rob Thompson, too. Yeah.
Yeah, right. I think it was
otherwise,
like,
he had to pull
you
the
have to stop
fire Rob Thompson
pitching
too.
This guy. He's killing us. And he legitimately was. But I think overall, a good deadline for the Phillies, even though it's nothing major.
Oh, yeah. I think they gave up very little that is going to be useful to them, and they probably improved their chances of making the playoffs. No one thinks they're going to catch the Braves and Mets. So really they're fighting the Cardinals and trying
yeah, the
to
Giants
hold off
who we
Giants.
Can say did
that's basically the task.
Nothing.
I think they
really, right?
I
which
think
they should have sold Carlos
might
Rodon.
Do, which
they're,
was sell Carlos
they're,
Rodon.
They're four back right now of the yeah, as you said, the Phillies are in the third spot. They're tied with the Cardinals right now. Four back are the Giants, and then after that's 8.5. So it's really just those three teams. I don't know. The Giants are, I don't know. I don't think they're in it at this point, but good news for the Phillies. All right. Our last bullet here on the rundown, the Minnesota Twins. We discussed, they made a deal with Cincinnati. They got Tyler. I've been doing this for so long and I still don't know how to say his last name. Molly, okay. I swear someone's told me that every single time, and I never remember it. Tyler Molly, as RJ mentioned, it's Spencer Steer, Christian Encarnacion Strand, and RJ, I'm forgetting the last guy. Oh, pick me up. Come on. Oh, Steven Hadjar.
I failed you on this one.
Oh, so I was going to say, I know we've had reports at BP on Encarnacion Strand. Nathan Graham has seen him. We had an eyewitness report on him. He's a big guy who can hit it really far. He's got like power to go with the very long last name he sports. Right. So I think that was a nice get for him. Spencer Steer was at the Futures game, I believe. Right, Zach? Did you stand next to him? Okay, so we got nothing on that.
I believe
I don't know, RJ. What were your takes on the prospects? The Reds got back, and we could talk about what Molly does for the Twins.
Yeah. Well, I think he covered Encarnacion Strand correctly. With Steer, you know, he's kind of like a well-rounded guy. I don't know if there's a plus tool in his game, but at the same time, you know, sometimes these well-rounded guys become better big leaguers than they were prospects, right? So certainly open-minded about that one. And then with Hajar, that's how you say his name, correct? I'm not butchering that. You know, I think there's a chance he's a back-end starter. I mean, we'll see what the Reds do with him, if they can get a little bit more out of him. He's a big guy, big lefty. But, you know, it's fine. You know, Molly had kind of struggled this season. Obviously, I guess his numbers were better than I'm giving him credit for. He had struggled at a time this season, but I don't know. You know, thing is, he has that extra year of control, and he was probably the best starting pitcher after Montas came off the market. So I'm trying to do the calculus in my head on how fair of a return this was. I would say mostly fair. And again, Steer is never
short. Yeah, I mean, I would say, for Minnesota, I thought this was a nice pickup. They needed some help in the rotation at this point. And I think they're an organization. I know that their pitching coach left to go coach LSU, but they have done well kind of rehabbing pitchers broadly speaking. I know they ran into a lot of issues in 2021, but you know, Chris Archer has been a viable starter for them this year. And that's not something I had on my bingo card. Sonny Gray has gotten back into form for them. Joe Ryan was a breakout earlier in the season, has been roughed up a couple times as of late, but still a 3.78 ERA on the season. Molly has been a little bit above average for the Reds, who are also pretty good at developing some pitchers, but I don't know. I like this for Minnesota.
I like I think Minnesota had a pretty obvious task of, like, the pitching isn't that good, so fix the pitching, and voila, you win the Central. So, like, understand what they were going for here. Certainly, you know, they probably don't feel like their team is at the peak of the AL contention cycle right now, so getting a guy with an extra year of control makes sense. Have him around next year, see if you can work with him even more. We've seen flashes of some really, really good stuff from Molly, who has strikeout ability and has shown it more consistently at times than he has this year. But this is a guy who can be a number three starter on a very good team, and that's a good thing to have. I think the Twins have a little bit of a thing going, not as extreme as the A's or like the Rays with everything, but the Twins with their pitchers seem to like guys who just haven't been as good as you think they're supposed to be. And I don't know how often you do that before you're just like, maybe they just aren't that good. But I think they've collected just a whole bunch of number three to number two starters. Like, at their absolute peak, all these guys could maybe be number two starters. And if you're going to trade a pretty good package for a bunch of these guys, just go get Castillo. I'm not that impressed by getting the barrage of Molly, Lopez, and Fulmer. I think it's good. I think they needed a bunch of guys, and I understand the logic. I don't know. I was a little, like, if you were looking at a team that actually had the incentive, like a surefire playoff spot if they reach out and grab it, a good core that could be around for a couple of years. Like,
I don't think they were. I mean, that was a hell of a...
Maybe they just weren't going to beat that Seattle package, and that's reasonable. But I would have liked to see them go bigger on the pitching front, but I think it was a good move under the circumstances.
They did try for Montas, based on reports. I will add with Molly, and this is my final note on him, I don't know how much you read into home road splits at this level, but his home numbers have been far worse than his road numbers for his career, and I wonder if they just think that he's going to achieve a higher level of production without having to pitch in the Great American Ballpark all the time. So whether there's stuffing there or not, I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see, because we're talking a 5.02 ERA at home and 55 appearances, and we're talking a 3.74 ERA on the road and 59 appearances, and better strikeout to walk ratio at home, far fewer home runs. So, and when I say far fewer home runs, I mean he gave up 61 in 285 innings at home versus 28 in 308 innings.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I'll say in terms of, like, go get Luis Castillo, and I'm not trying to go at you, Zach, but, like, I'm looking at their top 10 from our offseason list.
No, go for it.
It's like Austin Martin at the top, Jordan Belazovic, Joe Ryan was our third prospect. He's in the rotation. Chase Petty, they already traded to the Reds for Sonny Gray. Royce Lewis is hurt. Like, you know, the Matt Canarino, okay, Jose Miranda's on the major league team. You know, I guess you could potentially move him. Simeon Woods Richardson, not that great. Yoan Duran, that's like your you know, setup man. Josh Winder, he's been a depth guy. I don't know if the Reds, I don't think they can touch.
Setup man.
Yeah. I agree with that. I just don't know that they could afford bigger help.
But that's all to say. Yeah, I think they could have used bigger help, and maybe they couldn't have gotten it if they wanted. But
and that.
Yeah. I think they got outbid. Yeah,
exactly.
The question is,
exactly,
why couldn't you get Montas?
So I guess the other part, you know, Zach mentioned Fulmer. I thought that was fine. I don't know. Yeah, exactly. That they need some volume. That's fine. Jorge Lopez was the other one. Having an absolute breakout year as Lopez, the Orioles closer. The Orioles, not that far out of the wild card, opt to trade him. He's got 2.5 years of control. They got, I'm going to say, the poo-poo platter from Minnesota. Like, they got Cade Povich, who we've had a couple reports on from Nathan Graham over at BP this year. Yennier Cano. He's 28, I think.
Yennier Cano. He's a 28-year-old rookie. Yeah.
He has been in the majors a little bit.
He's got some stuff, right, but
they,
he also has
they've got
a lot of players,
Juan
so
Nunez
that?
And Juan Rojas, I think both who are complex level
guys. You know a trade is really cooking when you're trading an all-star for a four-player package, and 75% of those players are either 28-year-old rookies or complex ball pitchers who no one outside of the organizations have seen. So you just know it's going to be in fuego on Twitter and... Like, it's just going to be so lively and so misinformed.
But it did turn out to be lively on Twitter.
Yeah, because the Orioles are in that zone where it doesn't matter what they do, good or bad. It's discourse time whenever it happens. You know what I mean? Like, we're not going to have a normal Orioles trade for at least another 5 years, I guess. Because the thing is, like, Lopez is actually a really fun story. You know, he's gained velocity. He just chucks that sinker over and over, and... He's got years of control remaining. I mean, I see why Minnesota decided that he was worth pursuing. I kind of get why Baltimore would trade him, too, because I'm of the opinion that bad teams should always trade their pop-up relievers or even they're not pop-up relievers. And I don't think Baltimore was a serious playoff contender. I get the arguments for keeping him, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, for my money, this was it was fine, I guess. I don't know enough about the complex small pitchers to really have a strong take on that part of it, I suppose.
So, I guess my, you know, Lopez, one thing is that his July was pretty bad. Yeah. He had been absolutely incredible heading into July. He had a 1.59 ERA in April. He had a 0.75 ERA in May. In June, he did not give up an earned run. He did give up one unearned run. And then in July, he had a 4.76 ERA, allowed 3 home runs, which was he had not allowed a home run all season. You know, he allowed a slash line against of 304, 373, 544.
Yeah.
It's a bad month.
Yeah, I will say. I will
but
say
relievers
that.
Have those.
I will say, though. Here's the funny thing. If you look at his July and you take out the games against his new teammates, the Twins, that's... Two of the 12 games he pitched in, right? If you look at the over 10 games, 11 innings, 8 hits, 4 runs, only 2 earned, 3 walks, 14 strikeouts, 6.03 OPS against. You would take that. That's his last 10 outings
absolutely.
In July. So I think it's kind of you can't just remove their worst outings.
But I got you. It was two outings.
Against his new teammates. So he won't. If the Twins have the secret to him, they're getting ready to tell him what it is. Like if they picked up on a tell or what have you, right? So I don't know. It's hard. It's like with Hader, you know, you kind of look at the underlying things, and like you said, relievers sometimes just have a few bad outings and spurts for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of people making the case about the 2.5 years of control. I mean, maybe I'm just too jaded, but like, are we to believe that this is just the new Jorge Lopez? I don't.
Probably not.
No.
But
so like, about 2.5 years of that? Like, we're talking about Cano and like being a 28-year-old, like Jorge Lopez was a really interesting prospect for the Brewers once upon a time. Was with he had a hellacious curveball, is my recollection. He ended up in Kansas City, but like he's 29. This is the first time he's ever been good.
Yeah.
I don't care about 2.5 years of control with like almost any reliever. There's like, I mean, I could probably go through and list on my hands the number of relievers I care about 2.5 years of control with. So it's not a shot at Lopez. It's just not a consideration you take into account with relievers, especially not when you're the Baltimore Orioles, who would like something a little bit more substantial than a relief pitcher, possibly, out of, you know, when you're looking at what to do at a trade deadline. But, I think it makes sense for the Twins, but they're probably thinking about him for the next 2.5 months, not 2.5 years.
I will say, on the point of, you know, the relievers being flaky and whatnot, there's probably a reason the Orioles got back what they did, right? So I'm not even sure how much the Twins valued that extra years of control, because they didn't give up anyone from their top 30. They gave up, Povich was in their top 30, but I don't know. I get why they did the trade. I also get why Orioles did it. I just don't know enough about the complex arms to really have a strong take on the overall deal, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We have gone just about 90 minutes here. I want to close out on one team, the one team that did not make any moves today. The Colorado Rockies. I shouldn't say today. The entire deadline. The Colorado Rockies.
Well, Craig, they did make a move.
Okay.
They extended a 37-year-old reliever who recently had the yips for 2 years for a team that isn't going to win anything.
Yeah, I don't mind that. The problem is,
you don't mind
the GM
that
comes out and says, "I don't," because I don't know what are they going to get back for him, you know. But no,
Kate Povich and
some complex
the complex arms and a 28-year-old rookie. What are you talking about? Listen, what are you going to get for him? We know what they get for him.
There you go. But no, beyond that, the GM coming out and saying we're the only team to sign a player to an extension at the deadline, and he's not even the only right-handed pitcher in the National League West who signed an extension this week. He's not even the only player in the National League who signed an extension in the last 24 hours. I don't know, man. Like, I've always heard good things about Bill Schmidt. That was an unfortunate mistake on his part because, it just plays into the idea that the Rockies see a different game, and God bless them for that, because old-school incompetence is so much more better than the new-school indifference.
I don't think that it plays into that, RJ. It is that. Like, this is the Rockies. I'm going to read the full quote from Nick Groke, who covers the Rockies for The Athletic. So he says, asked about the Rockies being the only team not to make a deadline trade, Bill Schmidt said, quote, we were also the only club to sign a player to an extension at the deadline. 29 other clubs didn't sign anybody to an extension. And then this is Groke's commentary. Well, no, that's not true. But honest mistake. Go ahead, Zach.
I mean, the Rockies have always been disadvantaged because they play at altitude or whatever, but based on how they act, you would think they were playing from space. I mean, it is just, how do you not remember the Austin Riley trade extension or the Joe Musgrove extension if you're the GM of a team?
As RJ said, in the division. Joe Musgrove was in the division.
Well, clearly they weren't thinking about trying to sign Joe Musgrove this offseason.
This club, I don't remember. Did they trade anyone last deadline? Either obviously they did not trade Trevor Story. No, they did not trade John Gray.
And then, of course, they had that story come out that I think it was Groke who pointed out that the Rockies were upset that John Gray's agent talked to other teams or negotiated with other teams last offseason. So
yes,
it's not been a banner week for the Rockies. But like I said, I prefer them. I prefer old school incompetence to new school indifference. And I will just note, this episode is brought to you by new school indifference. Why try?
I hear you on preferring that. I think it was Nick Groke as well. But what you're referring to is they said that the Rockies were like disgruntled or something like that, or maybe furious or something, that John Gray. They had planned on re-signing John Gray after the season, and then his agent went and got him a better deal in Texas, and they were furious about this. That's his job, man. That's the agent's job.
Yeah, here's the... Here is the text from the article that Nick wrote at The Athletic. The Rockies had been burned by John Gray's decision to sign with the Rangers last winter after they failed to sign the right-handed starter to a contract extension before he became a free agent. And they have quietly fumed since that if not for Gray's agent trying to find him a better deal, he'd still be pitching in purple. And yes,
I guess, did they learn their lesson on that and say, we can't let Bard go? We have to lock him down now?
I mean, you look at the extensions they've handed out elsewhere on this roster. CJ Krohn, right-handed first baseman. He's
I actually love him for that. He's perfect in Colorado.
Yeah, but you know, Craig, how hard is it to find a right-handed first baseman?
I hear you, but he's like perfect for them.
Colorado. Yeah, that's fine.
If the Rockies did not know that agents are out to get their players a better deal, that would explain a lot about the Chris Bryant signing.
They also signed Elias Diaz to an extension. And again, how hard is it to find a glove first catcher on who's in his?
Yeah, they thought his offensive breakout was real. I'm pretty sure it was not. No, so listen, the Rockies are so pure. You know, they are so pure in what they are, and I just this one thing where his response to being asked about not making a deadline trade. And they have, like, Jose Iglesias, right? Like, they could trade Jose Iglesias. Someone would take him.
Yes.
He's been performing well. I know he's lost a step or two, but, like, he's still a solid defender. They didn't trade anyone, and he said, but we were the only club to sign a player to an extension at the deadline. It's not the extension deadline. Other clubs can still sign guys, their own guys. It's fine. No, there's no rules against that. And then having it be not remotely true and have two extensions signed since they signed their guy to an extension, it's just... You guys, when I tell you I was sitting alone in my office just wheezing.
They have other guys that could have moved.
And tears in my eyes at this guy.
Mitch and Iglesias.
I don't... It was just... This club is so incredible.
By the way,
what a gift.
Brian McMahon's offensive breakout being legit, and so far, no so good on that one either. I don't know. Yeah. They had a 4-win season, according to Baseball Reference.
He had a 4-win season or something like that.
OPS plus doesn't appear
to be real.
At this point, that's not a good sign.
And they also have
I didn't know if it was that good, though, right? Like,
he's a good defender. Time that they, you know, they'll probably sign all of them to extensions too. But
why wouldn't you move Iglesias to a team who needs a second baseman?
Jose Urania. They called him up. But they talked about extending him.
Why?
I didn't know he was on the team.
Correct.
He's 30 years old. He's made 5 appearances.
He has a 5 ERA.
Starts. He has a 1.23 strikeout to walk ratio. I don't know, man. That's a thinker.
This club, I get so much joy out of the Rockies. What a magical team. I thought that was the perfect capper to this trade deadline special. Thank you both for joining me again after last year's marathon. I think we did this one in a little more tidy fashion. We didn't get to every deal like last time, but I think that's okay. I want to give you guys the opportunity to plug your websites, your work, whatever you're doing. Zach, why don't you lead us off on that front?
You can read my work at Yahoo Sports, and you can find me on Twitter at zkreiser, ZCRIZER.
Beautiful. RJ?
Yeah, you can go to cbssports.com/MLB, and I would encourage you to read the others, Dane Perry, Mike Exceeds, and Matt Snyder. And if you stumble upon one of my pieces, all I ask is that you let some autoplay ads run.
Do RJ a favor and let those ads run, guys. Thank you both for joining me again. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of Five and Dive, brought to you by the Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network and our Patreon supporters. You can support our Patreon at patreon.com/fiveanddive. You can get in touch with the show at fiveanddive@baseballprospectus.com. We are wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network, and we'll be in that feed If you like what we're doing, throw us a rating and review. We really appreciate it. Thank you again, and I'll try and get another one of these out later this week to cover any of the trades that we relevant trades that we didn't cover in this one. Thank you again, and we'll see you then.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.